This is the state of things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Phoebe Judge, and for Frank Stacio. Eunice Wayman was born in a wooden three-room house in Tryon, North Carolina. Her talent on the piano was obvious from an early age, and despite segregation, community members came together to fund her musical education. But Eunice never became the great African-American pianist her community expected. Instead, she took a job singing jazz in an Atlantic City nightclub, and she went on to become known as Nina Simone, the so-called High Priestess of Soul. The community of Tryon kept the home Nina Simone was born and raised in standing. It recently went on the market and was purchased by four New York City-based artists. Blue Ridge Public Radio reporter Helen Chickering visited Tryon. She spoke with community members about their memories, and she talked with the new homeowners. She joins me with the story today. Welcome to The State of Things, Helen.
Thanks, Phoebe. Thanks for having me.
So how does the world know Nina Simone?
The world knows Nina Simone many ways. I mean, she hit New York jazz clubs with Porgy. She's known for her shift from artist to artist activist with many songs during the civil rights era. So it really depends on when you fell into her music. I'm a big fan of that whole spectrum. So it's hard to say, you know, it depends really on your taste and how you sort of found Nina.
Well, let's hear Nina Simone singing her 1965 song, Feeling Good.
Fish in the sea, you know how I feel. River running free, you know how I feel. Blossom on the tree, you know how I feel. It's a new dawn, it's a new day, it's a new life for me, and I'm feeling good.
That was Nina Simone singing Feeling Good. So that's how the world knows Nina Simone. But Helen, how does the town of Tryon know her?
So she grew up in the town of Tryon, and the home that was the focus of our story was her birthplace, where she was born in 1933. Her father, they moved from South Carolina. She was number six in the line of kids. And he came to Tryon at a time when the town was thriving. He opened up a dry cleaning business and had different jobs. Her mother was a Methodist minister, and that's where she got her musical start. She played the piano in the church, and it was known quickly that she was talented. And the town's piano teacher, Muriel Mazanovich, known as Miss Mazzy, heard about her and actually called her to her house and said, you know, I want to hear this child play. And her mother recounts the story and says, you know, she got word back that Nina has a gift, and the town pitched in and supported piano lessons and really cultivated her career. And that's where the dream and the hopeful career path to classical piano began.
Will you tell us about the actual house itself that she grew up in?
So the home, as you mentioned in the beginning, was small, 660 square feet, three rooms. They didn't have running water. I don't know if they had electricity. Don't think so. But Nina recounts it is a wonderful home, and it stayed intact miraculously throughout the years. It was slated for demolition in 2005. A resident and local development commissioner, Kip McIntyre, reached out, saved the house, poured tens of thousands of dollars into the home, fell on hard times, and had to sell it, and it eventually landed on the market in December.
Let's go back to Nina Simone growing up in Tryon in the 30s and 40s in the South. What role did segregation have in shaping her early years?
I think a very important role. And so going back to the story, the community supported and financially supported her development as a classical pianist. At the same time, segregation was in place, and Nina recounts a story that one of her fundraising recitals when she was 12, I think, held at the local library. Her parents walk in the room, sit down in the front right before she's going to play, and they are escorted to the back. And Nina stands up and says, nope, not going to play until my parents come back to the front. And they did. And she talks about that. But the town talks about that, too. And some of the residents we interviewed, you can feel that that struggle, that pull, the support of a local talent at a time where segregation was in place. And I think that wove itself into her career later in life when she made the turn from artist into artist activism with songs and writing many, many songs.
Let's hear a clip of Nina Simone talking about that early experience she had with segregation.
It touched me first time when I gave a concert, a recital at age 12, and they wanted to put my mom and daddy on the back row. And I remember standing up quite bravely and said, "Oh no, my mom and dad will sit on the front row."
That was jazz and soul legend Nina Simone. She never lost that kind of outspoken defiance. How did she involve herself in the civil rights movement after she had become known as Nina Simone?
So recounting that piano recital incident, you see that shift, and a big shift after the church bombing in Alabama in 1963, where four young girls were killed, and also the murder of Medgar Evers. She writes a number of songs. She performed one of them, a big concert during the historic march from Selma to Montgomery in 1965. There's a story that when she met Martin Luther King, she went up to him and said, I'm not a peaceful protester," and he said, "Oh, that's fine." So you can feel it, and she sings with fire. I mean, you can just, if you look at, you can, you know, find her on YouTube and some of those performances. So her career really shifted from playing in nightclubs and jazz clubs like the Village Vanguard and the Village Gate to really attending rallies and concerts with meaning.
Well, let's listen to Nina Simone singing, "I Wish I Knew How It Would Feel to Be Free."
I wish I could give all I'm longing to give. I wish I could live like I'm longing to live. I wish I could do all the things that I can do.
That was Nina Simone singing her 1967 song, "I Wish I Knew How It Would Feel to Be Free." Nina Simone went on to great success. How was she perceived at home back in Tryon?
So a lot of people, first of all, didn't know that Nina Simone was Eunice Wayman. So in our story, we talked to one of the residents who says, "You know, I heard Nina Simone in the Village Gate. And it wasn't until later I realized, oh my goodness, we grew up in the same town." And another resident had the same piano teacher. So first of all, there was a disconnect just because of the name change. There was a bit of a struggle about that and about her relationship with her hometown, because she was active in the civil rights movement. She spoke out about that incident that happened in her hometown in the piano recital where her parents were escorted to the back of the room. And then she spent the latter part of her life in Europe and other places far away from home, although she did visit home. So I think there was a disconnect, and there's sort of speculation that there was some resistance after her death to reconnect Simone to her hometown. That has since changed. There's now a Nina Simone statue in a Nina Simone plaza, but there was a struggle there, I think.
I'm speaking with Helen Chickering about Nina Simone today on The State of Things. So tell us about the artists who ended up buying her childhood home and their plans for it.
So they found out, like everybody else, there was an article published in the local papers about this house going for sale. There happens to be an artist that has a second home in Saluda, which is outside of Tryon. He connected, his wife happens to be a curator at the Museum of Modern Art, contacted a couple of artists in New York. One of them was Adam Pendleton, that's who we featured in our story. He's a conceptual artist. And he said urgently he felt the need to buy it right away. And then he realized other artists had been contacted. And in the end, there were four. Now there are four homeowners. They're interesting. One's a filmmaker, one's an abstract painter and sculptor. So their plans, Adam Pendleton put it this way. He said, "Helen, we're dealing with the nuts and bolts right now, just making sure the roof is okay, not leaking, and we've got to mow the grass." They're working on a blueprint. Definitely want to preserve her legacy. But he said, we're artists and we're good at figuring this kind of stuff out. So what it will end up, we know the house won't leave, but what will become of it is still up in the air.
Well, let's hear from Adam Pendleton and what he had to say about
I think
house.
On the part of all of us, all four of us, there was really just simply a sense of urgency that what a great opportunity to step up and protect something that has such significant symbolic importance that can serve to represent, I think, in a profound way, all that Nina Simone has meant and means for American culture.
So the house still has some work to be done on it, but someone is going to give it good attention, it sounds like.
Yes, and the good thing is the effort by the community, by Kip McIntyre and others, there's a Nina Simone project, which has also raised money, kept the house intact. So it's kind of amazing. It's tiny. It sits up on cinder block pylons and that it is still here. And so the next step, and that will be probably doing some restoration and then perhaps there's going to be a Nina Simone tour, a Nina Simone app. Huh. So hopefully this will be a stop on that tour.
That's Helen Chickering, a reporter for Blue Ridge Public Radio. Helen, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you, Phoebe. It was a pleasure.
You can find out more about Helen's reporting at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, meet the professor who helped expose the water crisis in Flint, Michigan. You're listening to The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill.